Greetings and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are Canada's video game podcasting here with you recording on Thursday, August 16th of the year 2012. How are you all doing, friends? Welcome back. Welcome anew to any of you who are joining. Hopefully some of our existing friends, existing listeners have spread the word to their friends. Hopefully it's gone viral, much like gonorrhea. Though, you know, not with any of the nasty side effects and consequences.
Indeed.
I am Mike the Legend here with you, and spewing the good spew, all that there is to spew into your head through your car speakers, and making sure you turn it up loud enough so the people in the lane next to you can hear as well.
Yes, I agree with that sentiment, and I am Dennis, whose this week nickname is the man who doesn't know where he's going to get his fix of dressage and synchronized swimming now that the Olympics are over.
It's pronounced dressage.
Oh, I'm sorry, dressage.
Dressage.
I'm sorry, I was just reading the words that were written here for me this week.
Are you saying that you do not truly believe that or are concerned about getting your fix of synchronized swimming or dressage now that the Olympics are over?
I'm more of an uneven bars person myself.
Really?
No, that's not true at all. I just thought I'd have something to add to the conversation. And unfortunately, it sounded too serious. Synchronized swimming.
You know, there is an art, a beauty, a majesty to it, much like there is in dressage, which for those of you who do not know dressage...
I didn't even know what dressage is.
Well, allow me to inform you.
Yes,
dressage is a little-known Olympic event, and in the Summer Olympics, which have just passed, taking place in London, in case you were in a coma for the past 2 weeks, dressage, one of the many lesser-known Olympic events in the Summer Games, that I should say, and this one, dressage, involves horse dancing. I don't know how... horse dancing. It's kind of like, say, the individual floor gymnastics routine.
But while riding a horse?
Yes. And all the work.
Or please don't tell me that it's just running beside a horse or dancing with a horse.
No, the horse does the work. The person is still, you know, riding the horse in the saddle, controlling it that way. But it's the horse who is doing all the prancing and galloping and all the maneuvering. The individual is simply riding atop. And there's a musical routine, and it's... If you can imagine what, say, again, floor gymnastics would be, but with the horse. Yeah, it's the combination of equestrian, like show jumping, where they're going over all the displays and the bars and whatever else, mixed with, again, individual floor gymnastics.
Now, is equestrian...
minus the ribbons.
Is equestrian an Olympic event?
It sure is. Not only individually, but team equestrian, by the way. Which Canada, in the team event, placed fifth, despite being a member down.
I see.
Indeed. Yes. Again, one of the lesser-known Olympic events. Right up there with some of the rifle shooting ones.
Well, yeah.
And every sailing event.
I didn't actually realize that there were still sailing events.
No, not just that there still are sailing events, and not to say that there's, you know, one or two. There are several different disciplines of sailing events. As I learned through the course of these summer games, there's 303 different events in the Summer Olympics.
Someone was bored at work, and I see, and they were...
I have come to learn things that I can no longer forget.
Dressage and the various forms of sailing are some of those things,
yes,
I would assume.
And for the record, these are Olympic events. Baseball is not an Olympic event.
Well, I guess you have to...
It was dropped for the... Not to say they were dropped in favor of dressage, but just in general, the Olympic Committee decided, we will drop these events, we will add these ones. Really? Do you know what you're adding? Really?
Well, I guess it...
Did I miss something? Is this big in Europe?
I guess it has... It's, you know... to scale, I guess, and maybe not every country is Canada or the United States, just like not every country is various countries in Africa, or what have you. I mean, maybe dressage is popular in somewhere in Eastern Africa somewhere.
Are you trying to boil it down to different strokes for different folks?
Sure. I mean, that's also why Canada always does so poorly in the Summer Olympics and is one of the dominating forces in the Winter Olympics. And also why you don't really see, I don't know, South American countries do well in the Winter Olympics either.
A fair point indeed. One thing I have learned from the past 2 weeks of watching the watching the 2 weeks of Summer Olympics coverage, I prefer the winter ones because the events seem more easily discernible of, yes, you're the winner because you're the fastest. Whereas there are many other ones, be it dressage, be it many of the martial arts or, say, wrestling events or diving, where I don't understand them.
Yeah.
The judging, the scoring system entirely escapes me.
It's all stuff I can't do. That looks as equally impressive as the last guy. I don't know why he got a 6 and the other guy got a 10. They both look pretty good.
Nothing entirely discernible as to one or the other as being significantly better. I do not see it. Perhaps I have untrained eyes, and this is maybe something that the listeners can chime in on and perhaps share their opinion with. Just because you couldn't escape it on television, even if you tried. Five different channels of Olympic coverage, so you couldn't escape it, even if you wanted to. But did we miss something? Is dressage really deserving of being an Olympic event? Email us info@thearcadeshow.com, or again our straight up website, thearcadeshow.com. So we'll move along from that now that the call to action has been put out, but we move along seemingly into yet another call to action as we speak of, as we've spoken in the past few months of many Kickstarter campaigns that have been very successful and set many records and raised many dollars with their aim to fund the production and distribution of a video game. We first spoke of the Double Fine Adventure campaign, yes, done by Tim Schafer, which raised oodles of cash. We then most recently spoke of the Ouya campaign for a brand new Android-based home video game console.
Yes,
again,
no,
raising oodles of cash, but there's a new one for perhaps a more noble and just cause.
Yes, well, I was going to say, the thing about Kickstarter and another site in specific, which I'm going to be mentioning in a second, Indiegogo, it's not just video games. We only talk about the video game ones generally because they're the most relevant to our program, but mm-hmm, there are plenty of super wildly successful Kickstarters and Indiegogo campaigns out there that are totally not related to video games.
And there's so many. There's just an absolute dearth of them on both Indiegogo and Kickstarter.
Yeah.
It's hard to find one to shine a light on.
Yeah, but there's tons and tons of people raising tons of cash for a lot of different ideas, a lot of different causes, and whenever something that kind of, you know, tickles our fancy, being, you know, of the nerdier, geeky kind of ilk who browse the internet and are try to keep up with, you know, culture of, you know, the memes and such.
Indeed.
And what have you on the internet. There's been a, you know, one of the champions on the internet of, well, comics and the things that, you know, your friends often spread around on Facebook and what have you, is the Oatmeal. Which, you know, he's kind of made a name for himself in the last, you know, 3 or so years about, really, just interesting things, like, you know, his quizzes that he had initially, like the, how many zombies could you beat in a whatever. I don't know. He had a ton of different ridiculous quizzes. And then his comics, of course, are also notable, and he had one that I recall, I think was the first one I saw, was his big rant on punctuation, that he basically goes into great detail, but without, you know, boring you. And you know, basically, if you want to check out The Oatmeal, it's pretty funny, theoatmeal.com.
Indeed.
But I'm not just plugging theoatmeal.com for no reason, because that serves no purpose for our show.
Exactly, and he hasn't paid us for it, so why bother?
Yeah, but every now and then, like in the last little bit, him in specific, he's been attached to a couple of notable fundraising kind of events. The first one was just spawned out of nothing, and we didn't talk about it at the time because, well, really, it wasn't as ridiculous and wasn't as, well, explosive with how much money it raised. But it was for a charity for, you know, funding breast cancer and the Wildlife Foundation mm-hmm. in the United States for... There was a big thing with some site that was one of those aggregate websites where anyone can upload content and, you know, anyone can thumbs up, thumbs down it, but, you know, the content doesn't have to be owned by you. It's basically just like a dump stuff in here website, and it just shows random images and you can link to them. And I guess people uploaded oatmeal comics to this thing, and he was finally, you know, he got sick of it, and he basically posted a big rant about why that the website's garbage and blah, blah, blah. Anyways, it led to this big thing, and he ended up making a big, huge contribution to two different charities as a result of this. So I guess he must have realized, hey, I can do a lot of good with all my clout on the internet. So his recent one, it's also no secret that he's a big fan of Tesla, Nikola Tesla, the pioneer of basically modern electricity.
Indeed.
I mean, you could even say he invented modern electricity.
The pioneer, the inventor, the thinker, scientist, researcher of the time that was always overshadowed by Edison.
Yes, unfortunately. But yes, if you read up on Tesla, there's a lot there to be, you know, intrigued about. But and he did most of his work in the United States, but Tesla never had a museum or anything really attributed to him ever. Because I guess he was always overshadowed by Edison, and there is a Tesla museum somewhere in Europe, wherever he originally came from. I don't recall offhand, I apologize. But he did most of his work in America, and his laboratory that he did his work in until 1917, I guess, when he ran out of funds and he went crazy and stuff, is still standing, but is at risk of being demolished. So he... The oatmeal, in conjunction with a society of people who I guess he just found by whatever means, are looking at buying this whole building and land off people to actually preserve it as a museum. Now, you know, that obviously doesn't cost... Well, it's not a cheap endeavor.
No, it's not a simple cup of coffee. It's you're buying a whole piece of land, which is It's a respectable chunk of land in New York, and you also are paying, no doubt, for the century old building that is still standing, and it's not going to come cheap these days, even with well, perhaps depressed land values and property values in America.
Yes, that's true, but I guess the long and the short of it is this charity needed to raise $850,000. So that the state of New York could also match $850,000 so that they can then bid on this property, and then after buying this property, they can then permanently protect the property as an historic site. Sounds, you know, noble enough.
With the ultimate aim of turning it into something to...
Well, yeah, with the ultimate aim of turning it into a Tesla museum. Of course, the $1.7 million is just the start. They would, of course, need more funds later.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I guess the first step was just protecting the site just so then they can just get some breathing room.
Exactly. I mean, if you're going to put a Tesla museum somewhere, you need a plot of land. You need a building to actually house it. And what better place than the place he worked and toiled away until madness took hold.
Indeed. But, at any rate, as of the recording of this show, which is we record on Thursday night, we're recording this Thursday night, August 16th. It wasn't a Kickstarter, it's an Indiegogo, because I guess Kickstarter doesn't support not-for-profit endeavors and charities and stuff,
mm-hmm.
but Indiegogo's platform does. So, as of our filming... We're movie stars, apparently. Our radio...
Recording.
Sorry, force of habit. The Indiegogo page had been up for, I think, 26 hours, 27 hours?
Yeah, seemingly went live at about 3 p.m. Central Standard Time on Wednesday. August 15th. So at the time we were recording this, it's been up for about a day, just over a day.
Yeah, and it was put up, you know, they gave it 45 days to try to raise $850,000. As of right now, they've already raised $485,000. Like, over half of what they need in a day. So, I think it's, if this goes through, which it's looking like it might, this is just proof that if the internet gets behind a good enough cause, you could pretty much do anything.
I think this is just further proof and further reinforces kind of what we saw with, say, the Double Fine Kickstarter, with the Ouya Kickstarter, is that, yes, definitely when the internet not only gets behind and believes in something, the internet has money, and the people of the internet will, or are willing, to put their money behind a cause that they believe in.
Yes. All they need is a decent enough coat of paint on, you know, the sign advertising it, and... Yeah, I mean, the oatmeal is definitely not a bad thing to be endorsed by or having help by.
Certainly not. The oatmeal, as you said, has a lot of clout, has a lot of goodwill on the internet, and a very large following on the internet, and choosing to use that for good and not evil in this case. And I have to say, I love the name of what this campaign is. The yes. Oatmeal dubbing this page, this campaign, the... or calling it, quote, Operation Let's Build a Goddamn Tesla Museum.
Yes. Because, well, if there's one thing the oatmeal's good at, it's getting people's attention.
Sure is. And now, with this $485,000 that's been raised already, if you're familiar with these fundraising campaigns, there's many different increments of... many different levels that you can pledge to, like a PBS a pledge drive that we see 4, 5, 8 times a year. Swear there's more every year, but we're familiar with how that works. You give 25, you get this, 50, you get that, 700,000, you get the tote bag. Or
yeah, now granted, you're not, when you're pledging money to these things, you're technically not buying the things,
mm-hmm.
because, like, you're not supposed to think of it that way. You're just really thinking of, like, okay, this is a cause I support, I'm going to give money. But, you know,
maybe, getting something is just a nice bonus.
Like, if I give a little bit more, I'll get a coffee cup. Yeah, I might as well give a little bit more. I know a coffee cup's like $1 to make, but yeah, I'll give you an extra $20. Sure, fine. But this one, I guess, you know, it's interesting. They've already sold out of most of the low-level, low-hanging fruit perks. Actually, I'd say all of the low-level perks are totally sold out, and even one of the higher-level perks has been sold out already.
There's a $25 level, $50 level, and as well levels for $100 and $500, respectively, and all of those, at the time of recording the show on a Thursday night, have been sold out.
Yes, in addition to the $1,000 level, which is the next level up from the $500, 22 of 40 packages for that level have been claimed. Now, I'm going to guess that if you still only have like 10 or 20 bucks or whatever to donate, you can still do that without mm-hmm. having, you just won't get anything for it.
It's like, thanks, well, nothing for you. Not even a keychain.
Yeah, but that's my only concern of this thing keeping up the level of steam, but since the next level up is 1,000, then 2,500, then 5,000. Those are the only three perk levels left.
So if you have a whole bunch of money, and this ties in nicely with something we've spoken of the past few weeks here on the Arcade in our Ludicrous Leadoffs, is that if you have just a whole bunch of disposable money sitting around and don't know what to do, if you don't want to spend it on a mech or anything like that, as we've spoken about, you know what? Maybe you believe in Tesla. Maybe you're a fan of Nikola Tesla and want to get behind this and support it. There are still plenty of packages available in the $5,000 level, which will get you a night's accommodation at the New Yorker Hotel and attendance passes to a big event in New York City, which you have to get yourself to. But presumably, if you have that level of wealth and disposable income, getting to New York is not a problem for you.
Exactly.
You probably just have to, you know, give your helicopter pilot notice properly, and
then you can make a truly proper entrance to the party.
You know, it's the helicopter pilot you need just to take you to your private airport, to then take your chartered plane to New York.
Where you take your helicopter there to the party.
Yes, exactly. Yes. He's just strapped to the roof of the plane, I'm sure.
Yes. But yes, that wasn't even our ludicrous leadoff this week.
No,
just an interesting thing to talk about. If you're interested in this, go to indiegogo.com/Tesla Museum. It's an interesting cause. I mean, I personally use electricity for things.
I've been known to enjoy electricity once or twice in my day. Yeah. It's a nice thing to have every once in a while.
Yeah.
I'm not an all-the-time fan of it, you know, but it's, you know, I like it. I like the idea of it. I like that it's just there.
I mean, it's a bit mainstream, but...
You know, it may have sold out a while ago, but, you know, I can still respect its indie roots, you know? And for that, yeah, I can dig this. I can get behind it. Again, this is a Tesla museum that would go up in New York, so if you're also a fan of Nikola Tesla yourself, you would have to get to New York to partake and enjoy in this museum, should it actually come to fruition, which... as of now, looks good. Again, there's 44 days left on the drive. So
they're just over a day, and they've already got half the money that they needed. So,
and that's not even taking into account if there's any corporate support going to this charity as well.
Yeah, that's the interesting other part about this. The Oatmeal, Matthew Inman, he on Twitter, he tweeted at, and basically on his website and his blog, he made a big call out to numerous big companies, including General Electric, Chase Morgan, and
Tesla Motors, actually.
Tesla Motors in specific as well, basically saying, hey, you know, giving reasons why it might be cool for all these companies to, you know, give some money, because, you know, giving money to a nerdy kind of thing like this makes the internet love you. And Tesla Motors already said, yeah, we'll give some money, which is awesome. I mean, if I was him and I just tweeted at Tesla Motors and they tweeted back going, sure, I think I'd be crapping my pants. Like, holy crap, I have that much power on the internet? That's insane.
Huh. I started off just drawing silly little comics that I liked and amused me and me alone. Now I have actual large multi-million dollar companies responding to my tweets, which are calls for money. Huh.
Why didn't I think of getting rich sooner?
I choose to believe that Matthew Inman then quickly engaged in maniacal finger tenting.
Yes, of course, saying excellent over and over again,
as he should have, as anyone would in that cause, but in that moment. But again, indiegogo.com/Tesla Museum, or you can find a link on our website, thearcadeshow.com. We'll move right along from that to the ludicrous leadoff.
Yes, almost halfway through the show, we apologize, but no, we got to get it started, and it was, well, we had some stuff to talk about.
Exactly, and we have some other good stuff to talk about, and we will start with a fantastic ludicrous leadoff, and I just love it. When I saw this piece come across the wire, it made me smile like the Cheshire Cat. It was a glorious day.
Before we start, I'd love to say that this is going to be the third time we've talked about this, and I don't think it's going to be the last.
Oh, heavens no. Heavens no. If you've listened to this program at all in, say, the past few weeks in specific, or in the past few years that we've been doing this this program, you might have heard once or twice me specifically air my disdain for the Insane Clown Posse.
Yes.
And I choose to believe I'm not alone in that.
No, you're not. Well, I also have disdain for the Insane Clown Posse, though I wasn't as vocal about it on the program as you were.
Not nearly as passionate, but you're a quiet supporter, and I respect that all the same. And I'm sure I'm not alone in the world with that regard. And we spoke a few weeks ago on this program of the fact that former 16-time world heavyweight champion Ric Flair was going to be a guest at the Gathering of the Juggalos, which, if you're unaware, if you've never heard of, it's It's the Insane Clown Posse's music festival that happens every year in Illinois, in some place called Cave-In Rock, Illinois, which apparently is a private property, so I'm assuming they just rent the land from some farmer or whoever owns it, and they stage a giant concert, giant music festival.
Music festival, carnival, con, really, like a convention almost.
It's
like a convention for Insane Clown Posse and Psychopathic Records fans.
Yes, and we spoke of Ric Flair going to be there, who apparently didn't make it through his whole night of hosting the main stage. I think it was Friday night, as this event happened last weekend. He was scheduled to host and introduce all the bands on the main stage for one night of the 4-day festival. Well, apparently, during the course of his being on stage, bantering with the fans of the Insane Clown Posse, again, just try and imagine that, fans of the Insane Clown Posse, Lows and Letts, all of them, in the crowd, and there's not a few, not dozens, not handfuls, there's thousands upon thousands who attend this event. It is not slim pickings. It is not the Morning Corn and Apple Fest.
Though it might as well be.
It's a very large and very interesting crowd that attends this affair. And then you have, on the other end, Ric Flair, who always presented himself, his wrestling character and persona, as being a very well-to-do, well-heeled character, in love with the better things and the more elegant and extravagant things in life.
Yes.
Jet flying, limousine riding, being one of his favorite terms. So you have these two, a great contrast between the two of them. And during the course of his night of hosting, some fan in the crowd, as fans at music festivals are wont to do, tossed a water bottle onto the stage, and it hit Ric Flair in the head, as I've come to understand it. It hit him in the head. That apparently was enough for him, and after that, Ric Flair said he was not going to go back on stage, and he basically, that was the end of his hosting duties for that night.
Yeah.
And as we know, these fans, they can be sometimes a little rowdy.
Yes.
They can maybe engage in some illegal activity, and, they seem like a threatening sort, these fans of the Insane Clown Posse, the Lows and Letts, which is short for Juggalos and Juggalettes.
Yes.
The names given to fans of the Insane Clown Posse, should you not have already been aware.
Yeah, which when I first heard it, I thought it was an insulting term. Like a derogatory term. Like, oh, look at that juggalo. Like, like almost like calling someone a hockey puck or something. But no, that's what they call themselves.
No. It's apparently not in the same family as calling someone a mouth breather.
Although it possibly should be.
Yeah. I consider it in the same regard, but nevertheless, it's the crowd, the fans of the Insane Clown Posse, they can be hyper, they can be rowdy, they can engage in illegal activity, maybe sometimes a bit of violence, and if you're to pass them on the streets, and sometimes with their neck tattoos of the Hatchet Man logo for the record label, you might feel a little threatened, you might feel a little uneasy around them. Well, it was last fall we spoke of the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation in America, who, as part of their National Gang Threat Assessment Report, listed the Juggalos to be a hybrid gang as part of their report. So essentially the FBI deemed them to be a gang threat.
Yes, a street gang. Albeit a decentralized one, but still a street gang where, they show the markings and how they normally dress and signs you can see if they're a member of the gang, et cetera, et cetera, and what they do. And it's normally just petty street crime, like, assaults and, like, buying and selling drugs, like marijuana and what have you, street-level drugs.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, two-bit activity.
Yeah, but, we had a big hearty horror about this, and then we surmised at the time that, the Insane Clown Posse being, marketing people who are in the marketing game for themselves might try to use this to their advantage.
True,
as it turns out, they're not using it to their advantage, and they're right pissed off about it. Specifically, Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope, who are the Insane Clown Posse,
yes,
who started the whole Juggalo movement, really.
Indeed.
They're being vocal about this, and they're saying some ridiculous things.
It was, I guess, their state of the Juggalo or Gathering of the Juggalo event, their sit-down powwow annual seminar that they have at the Gathering of the Juggalos, where Violent J and Shaggy Two-Dope kind of, they sit down, they powwow, and this year they were hyping on their Twitter account that they were going to be making a big announcement, quote, the biggest announcement of our career. And so during this sit-down session, this annual seminar, and this information coming by way of Camille Dodero, who is a reporter for the Village Voice media outlet, and she attended this and said that Violent J and Shaggy Two Dope, they sat everyone down, and apparently the biggest announcement of their career was the fact that, stemming from this determination, this assessment by the FBI that Juggalos are a hybrid gang, resulting from that, they've decided to now take legal action against the FBI. They are suing, or going to be in the process of suing, the FBI. And not only that, not only are they going to launch or take a litigious process with this assessment by the FBI, they're doing more than that. According to the record label Psychopathic Records, there's a website that's been launched called Juggalos Fight Back, in which Juggalos, Juggalettes, or even sometimes as they're called, Ninjas and Ninjettes.
I don't understand why. I don't want to know. That's it. But yes, if you are a fan of the Insane Clown Posse, and you are an American, first of all, this is an American thing, since it's just the United States of America where you're part of a street gang.
Here we just look at you funny.
Yeah. Now, if you are in America, you can contact the Psychopathic Records legal team pro bono if you have been treated unfairly by law enforcement.
Yes.
As a result of you being a Juggalo or a Juggalette.
Indeed. If you feel you've been discriminated against, unfairly targeted, perhaps some sort of civil rights, civil liberty been infringed upon, because you are a fan of the Insane Clown Posse and Psychopathic Records, the legal team wants to know, and it is the legal team of Psychopathic Records that is working on this case, working on the culminating and aggregating all these tales of oppressed Juggalos, oppressed Juggalettes. They're doing it all.
Oppressed Juggalism. Let's just call it Juggalism.
Yes, let's.
Sorry.
I know. But the legal team is doing it pro bono. No doubt at the behest of Violent J and Shaggy Two Dope. And they are hoping with these, what I'm sure they're figuring are many, many cases, many instances of unfair treatment, harassment by the fuzz, by the pigs, whatever the youths are calling them these days. They're hoping to build a legitimate case against the FBI's classification and spawn it, or spinning out from there, even further litigious processes. And no doubt wanting a complete reversal, their name stricken from the National Gang Threat Assessment, and I'm sure an open apology and legal fees, mental anguish, the usual sorts you go through and seek in an American lawsuit.
Now, it'll be interesting to see what the FBI's counter evidence will be for all of these quote unquote unfair harassments. I mean, I want to see, you know, when someone's saying, hey, how come the FBI is always doing blah, blah, blah to me? And then the FBI goes, well, because you were arrested 5 times for domestic abuse, or, you know, because we caught you 5 times selling pot to whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how are they planning on fighting this stuff? Like, I mean, lots of people can be fans of lots of things, and you would never know it to look at people.
No, that's true.
I mean,
like bronies.
Yes.
Oh, but man. We won't go
we
into
won't get
depth.
Into that. Yeah, but I mean, people have tattoos and stuff, and you'd never, unless most people, like, if you have a neck tattoo, it's kind of a little bit more like,
yeah, that's a louder display, more prominent display of something that you're into because it's on your neck.
Yeah, and you can't hide it. No, that's your decision, but I don't know. There's just people who are fans of things, even, like, you know, super fans of things. being a fan of something doesn't necessarily have to lead to going crazy over everything in a violent public display.
And we certainly...
We're breaking the law.
Yeah, we don't want to generalize and say that all fans of the Insane Clown Posse or Psychopathic Records are, in fact, criminals, the ones assessed by the FBI to warrant putting them on the this gang report. Not all of them are, but clearly enough have, well, undesirable characteristics that...
Well, my point is... There has to be a reason why they specifically brought this up in their report, the FBI, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, if you look at, like, you know, traditionally, like, heavy metal fans or Metallica fans or Slayer fans or something in the past, yeah, you know, some of them may have, you know, appeared to be violent or whatever, but I know a lot, well, being in a metal band and being listening to metal and music for years, I know lots of metalheads, and, you know, when they're not at a metal concert, they're usually relatively calm people who hold real jobs and...
are productive members of society.
Yeah, I mean, like, it doesn't really matter if, you know, I go home and I listen to Slayer over and over again and just, you know, woo, but who cares? You're a CEO of a company. You're allowed to do whatever you want. Great. Or even if you're just a McDonald's person. Cool. It's, you know, there's not as many super vocal carve Slayer into my arm people as there are get a neck tattoo of the Hatchet Man person. I'm just saying.
No, I understand what you're saying, and I'm intrigued to know if there's even a process in place for a gang that's been listed by the FBI as being a threat to have their name stricken from that report.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys are a gang, according to us and our intelligence and our information. We're not a gang. Prove it. I'm intrigued. If this ever gets to it, if this ever gets to court, I really want to see and really hope that Violent J and Shaggy Two Dope of the Insane Clown Posse show up to court, normal suits, looking all businesslike, with the face paint. That is the image I want.
Unfortunately, I think that's like... you'll be disappointed if that's the case. They're not going to dress like that. Despite the fact that, you know, it'd be funny, but this is not like the PMRC, you know, D. Snyder saying, hey, you're reading way too much into these lyrics, Tipper Gore, blah, blah, blah.
Well, even D. Snyder didn't show up in face paint in full garb.
Well, full enough. He looked totally unprofessional and had his, like, speech that he had and folded up in his back pocket a million times. But even still, he was also trying to prove more of a vast point, and that was more of like a societal thing. This is not a societal thing. Like, fans of their band commit violent acts in the name of the band is clearly what they're doing. Now, why don't they take action again, you know, with their fans, trying to maybe stop them from doing this? Like, hey, stop breaking the law and telling everyone that you're doing it because of us.
Now, the best part of all of this, the greatest irony, which I'm sure is lost on Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope, and perhaps some others in the Psychopathic Records family, perhaps even the legal team, is that on this during this music festival in Cave and Rock, Illinois, which I mentioned earlier, is a private property.
Yes, it's a private property.
So once they're there, pretty much anything goes, and law enforcement really doesn't have much leeway to just bust into there unless there's, you know, the imminent threat of violence and mass harm or what have you. But pretty much anything goes, and it's...
unless people from Cave in Rock are firing flares off to the neighboring houses and stuff and causing fires and stuff.
Exactly, but...
and being in noise complaints or what have you.
Some of the things that the FBI assessed, the points that they used to assess Juggalos as being a threat, I'm sure were being committed during the gathering of the Juggalos.
Yes. Selling drugs. Perhaps committing petty assaults.
Yes. You know, those types of things.
Yes.
And I really hope that maybe if this continues on, maybe next year at the 2013 Gathering of the Juggalos, maybe then Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope will take it as an opportunity to issue a call to arms and then essentially declare that Cave and Rock, Illinois will become a sovereign nation. They will secede from the United States.
Insane Clown Posse. Welcome to Insane Clown Posse. Because that they clearly need a national anthem. And that's it. I just wrote it. So if you're listening here, that's the what they're going to use, I'm sure.
And the flag, of course, would be, well, the national flag of Insane Clown Posse would, of course, be black and white with the Hatchet Man logo.
Yes.
Middle of the flag, in place of the Jolly Rogers. I'm reading way too much into this, and these are just grand visions I have that I'm sure will never come to fruition. But if they do, you can bet your bottom dollar I will tell you about them right here. Yes. I will not cease to tell you about them and point out how I was right. Because, damn it, sometimes I have to get that righteous.
Yes. Especially when we're talking about Juggalos.
Sure do. But perhaps we... Well, we can't always talk about Juggalos, and perhaps we should move on to something actually video game related.
Yes, since we've...
For the first time this program.
Yes.
Video game related.
We swear, we talk about video games on our show that's called The Arcade.
Yes, and not always do we ramble on about, you know, the latest things that come to our mind. No, this next Ludicrous Leadoff is actually video game related and ties in with something we spoke of, a news item that came up earlier this year, when we learned that apparently the Neo Geo Entertainment System was going to get a, well, another life, another kick at the can, so to speak.
Yes, SNK decided they've been out of the hardware game for long enough, SNK Playmore, that is, and they said, we've had enough, we're getting back into it.
And wisely so, and
yeah,
announced that they were going to release a portable system called the Neo Geo X Gold Entertainment System. Essentially, what it will be is a small little portable with a 4.3-inch LCD screen, a bunch of, you know, your standard mobile gaming device inputs and bells and whistles, would come preloaded with 20 old Neo Geo games into it, and it would also come with a docking station, which would allow you to, using an HDMI, output it to your TV so you can play Neo Geo games on your HD TV.
Yes, and use, like, classic-style Neo Geo joysticks, which would connect to it through whatever means.
Indeed. Now, we learned about it in January, but we haven't heard much from that point on until this week when SNK Playmore announced that not only are they still going ahead with plans to bring back the Neo Geo in, of course, a portable fashion, but it's actually going to come out worldwide on December 6th.
Yes, so mark your calendars. Get your Christmas lists ready if you are a big Neo Geo fan, because it's back, and it's actually happening.
It's actually happening, and it's expensive.
Yes, it's not the cheapest thing in the world. This is, you'd probably think, well, it's just, you know, there are devices out there already that exist, that they're even open source kind of devices you can buy, like, I think, the GP2X or something?
Sounds familiar.
It's like the popular emulation machine that you can buy online that's like basically sounds like this. It's a handheld device that I think it's like $60 or something you can buy, and then there's tons of software you can get for it and get whatever games on it for a number of systems, I'm sure, including the Neo Geo, but that's that, and this is an official Neo Geo system, which only plays Neo Geo games.
Indeed, but it comes preloaded with them, and, of course, you know, the docking station and a few other bells and whistles to warrant the $200 asking price.
Yes, $200 to be able to play, well, Neo Geo games. And you'll get 20 of them preloaded on the system.
You sure
will. Don't worry about that.
And some of them are staples, like Fatal Fury and King of Fighters and King of the Monsters.
And the first Metal Slug and, well, a number of different games. Those are
the ones that jump out. But
yeah.
$200 for a Neo Geo handheld. You know, I'm going to go ahead and say, not being a consumer analyst, not being a electronics industry analyst, I'm going to go ahead and say they've outpriced the market.
Yeah,
I'm going to make that leap of faith.
I think that's probably a safe thing to do. I mean, it's not really the best choice, in my opinion, to get back into the hardware market after being out of it and then release a handheld device
that only plays your old games.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, they maybe should have taken cues from some of the other bigger companies, seeing how that, you know, they're having issues competing with smartphones now.
I can see maybe if they did something like having something similar to the iCade, where it's a cabinet, just a neat housing for your iPad or iPhone or some contraption that goes around your smartphone, existing portable device that allows you to play Neo Geo games. Okay, great.
Or even a custom docking system that, lets you plug your iPhone into your TV and maybe through Bluetooth you can plug controllers in, because there's interfaces for that. I'm sure you can program your iPhone or Android device or whatever have you to use classic styled video game controllers.
But to go so far as to get back into the portable game business, that's a very expensive proposition. A very expensive proposition indeed. But we will let you know how this all turns out. There's still a few months between now and December, so events and things may change between now and then. But we will let you know how this Neo Geo handheld shakes down. And let us know if you're interested, if this is something that will actually turn your crank and you have $200 to blow on a Neo Geo handheld system. Let us know. Email us, info@thearcadeshow.com, and the straight-up website, thearcadeshow.com. We'll move along now to more video game news here on The Arcade. My God, we are busting at the seams, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
And we will move from Neo Geo to another company that is currently in the handheld space, in the hardware space in general, but they're a much larger player than what Neo Geo could even ever dream of being.
Yes, since they've kind of been established over the last 15, 20 years as being, one of the major players and a household name.
Indeed. Talking of Sony, who this week, or at least in the past few days, over at the Gamescom event in Germany, even before Gamescom started, they did a pre-show press conference, as they do for E3. Although at this Gamescom, they actually had, people buzzing. They actually had things announced that people were interested in, intrigued by. The first of which was they unveiled a new promotion called Crossbuy, in which certain PlayStation 3 titles or games released for the PlayStation 3 will get you, when you buy them, a free copy of that game for the PlayStation Vita.
Yes. The first one, of course, being revealed was PlayStation All-Stars Battle Royale, which we've talked about in the past as being the PlayStation ripoff version of Smash Brothers.
Indeed, but it comes out this November, and if that does turn your crank, then that's a nice little perk. You buy the PlayStation 3 version, and you get essentially a free bonus copy, just added on, no extra charge, which is certainly a nice perk, and a few other titles that will be part of this promotion, aside from Battle Royale, will include Sly Cooper, Thieves in Time, and Ratchet & Clank Full Frontal Assault, those being the first and only three titles announced for this promotion. But this is one aspect that in which Sony's actually acknowledging they still have a handheld system that maybe they should pay attention to again.
Yes.
So people can actually buy it and have a reason to buy it and play it, and then they can continue selling things too. This has kind of been one big criticism we had, especially coming out of E3, was that there was no originality. It was just predominantly sequels and existing franchises, existing properties. There was no imagination, no originality, no big surprises, nothing to catch our attention.
Yeah,
right?
So it seems like Gamescom, they either crammed like crazy down at the Sony offices between E3 and Gamescom, or they just simply weren't quite ready for E3, because they actually had quite a lot of stuff for Gamescom.
They sure did. In addition,
of course, to the Vita thing, like the
cross-buy promotion.
Cross-buy tried to keep people interested in the Vita. They actually unveiled a really neat-looking new game.
Indeed. They unveiled a number of new games, be it for the PlayStation 3 network or Vita, but we're going to talk about...
Specifically, the one for the Vita looks really neat.
Indeed, and it's going to be the first of four that we talk about here. First of four original, brand-new properties that they unveiled at Vita that not only are brand-new and original, but they look really, really interesting. And the first one, as you said, is for Vita, and it's done by a studio called Media Molecule. Name might not be familiar, but you've probably heard their other games they've worked on, namely Little Big Planet. So
yes,
they kind of know their way around a PlayStation Vita. And at Gamescom, they unveiled a new title called Tearaway. Now, Tearaway is not something you would commonly associate, a word you would associate with being a video game title. It's maybe something you'd associate with, say, tearing paper. There's good reason for that association.
Yes. The art style of this game is basically all paper. Your main character is a mailman messenger kind of delivery guy. I think his name is Iota.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he's got to deliver whatever the case is. He's got to go through this magical world of paper, you know, facing adversity and what have you. Standard video game stuff. But because of all of, like, the crazy stuff that there is in the Vita that I guess we apparently didn't know about.
Or just no one's really taken the opportunity to properly exploit.
Yes. Because of all this, they're using all of this stuff, and a lot of this stuff looks really crazy. First of all, I mean, it's a you have the standard video game controls kind of things, it looks like, when mm-hmm. it shows the people. Like, there's a trailer for it, and it looks, you know, that's first relatively standard. You know, you have your directional pad on the left, then you have your buttons on the right, and then the person's playing the game. But I guess because it's a touchscreen, they incorporate touchscreen elements into it, where, you know, you can kind of touch things and things happen. Okay, whatever. That novelty's already worn off.
Yeah.
We've had touchscreens for a few years now. Okay, and then different parts of the level, you have to kind of tilt the screen up because, oh, it just, you get a better look at things when it's vertical, and it's almost like a camera. Oh,
yeah.
Okay, that's
cool. You get to change the orientation of it.
Yeah, but again, we've had devices like that where you can change orientation for a few years now.
Neat, but okay.
Not totally, not the craziest thing in the world. Now, the other thing, I guess, it uses the accelerometers. Oh, neat. You move around, and, you know, it's almost like you get a different camera view of things.
Exactly. You can tilt it to the side. Okay, that's still neat. We kind of had, accelerometer functionality, say, with the Wii remote. Not entirely new.
And even with the six-axis, it's got it in there.
Exactly. But and also, to Tearaway, it also incorporates the microphone of the Vita as well, where you, apparently, there's times when you blow into the microphone to simulate wind at certain points in the game.
Or to just, you know, make a loud noise and simulate making a loud noise in the game. Okay, cool. Not the newest stuff in the world. Again, we've seen that stuff in the past. But then the other really cool thing is they have those sensors on the back of the device as well.
Yes, that rear touchpad.
Yeah, it seemed a little strange at the time, but when you see it used in this game, it's okay, Sony has the new crazy technology now. The interesting thing, because this game is all paper, when you put your fingers, when you touch the back of it, and you touch the back of the thing hard enough, your fingers poke through into the game. And all of a sudden, there's a whole other level of interaction there. And then, you know, you tap things to, like, make things fall off walls, and, like, you make your character jump up trampoline-y kind of things when you tap them. And
we shouldn't just say, or we should better say, and specifically say that not just will your, I guess, fingers touching the back of it have ramifications, have consequences. No, images of fingers will actually appear in the level.
Yes. Now, of course, there's other things that they use as well, like there's a camera. We don't want to spoil too much because you should really just check out the trailer yourself. But
indeed,
it's really, really cool. I mean, it's the combination of all these different technologies without trying to totally replace the original feeling of playing a video game, which I think is what makes this so neat, because in the past, I think when companies have hit on a new idea, like Nintendo with the Wii Remote, they kind of try to replace the original game experience with the new experience, instead of just extending the original experience with the new experience. So this is where this might actually look like it works a bit better.
And too, as we were talking before the show, these controls or these different implementations of the Vita technology, they don't seem forced. They don't seem like they're being shoehorned in. Whereas, say, with the example of the Wii, a lot of lesser third-party companies would shoehorn in Wii controls that just totally felt extraneous and just not appropriate.
Or like some of the early DS games as well. I think the Castlevania ones in specific were the worst for that. Like, where they were very Metroidvania style, as they called the titles, which were like Symphony of the Night and Onward,
mm-hmm.
Where you're basically playing like a mobile version of Symphony of the Night, which still is a very classically rooted Castlevania game where you use your controls, but then all of a sudden, every now and then, you have to pull out the stylus and then draw like a pentagram or something on the screen to seal some evil or whatever. And it just totally takes you out of the whole game experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, that kind of interaction, I'm glad they've kind of got around that, because that's, yeah, that takes you right out of the game.
And I have to say, too, at least with the art style and just everything about the approach and the aesthetic of what they're doing with Tearaway seems to fit.
Yes.
It all just, at least from the trailer, and of course, it's just a trailer, we haven't gone hands-on with it. We're not in Leipzig, Germany, or Leipzig, Germany, I should pronounce it properly as best I can. We're not there getting our hands on it, so we can't really authentically report, but at least on the surface, it all seems to work together, be it the music, the aesthetic of it, and just the idea of having your fingers on the back of it, maybe ripping through a level or a bridge or whatever else in the level, seems really, really interesting. And just, it captures, at least for me, it captured my imagination, thought, and gave me a reason to think, there's something on the Vita that's actually really neat.
Yeah.
Which I haven't had a thought of that in a damn long time.
I don't think I've ever thought that, to be perfectly honest, about the Vita yet.
I think clearly many other people have not had that thought because it's having troubles with sales.
Yeah, so it's about time that Sony's doing something about it. And that's not the only kind of interesting thing. They went kind of crazy with new games for a change.
New games, new first-party games that we're talking about here, the four being the most interesting to us. The next one was announced was a title for the PlayStation Network, born out of Sony's Japan studio. It's a title called Rain. Not to be confused with Heavy Rain.
No.
Or the Madonna song Rain.
Yes.
This is a new property all its own, and it's a open-world adventure platformer game in which, well, the aesthetic and the presentation of it seems really depressed, gray,
sort of
gloomy.
Depressed and gray, but basically, like, it brings a nice light to whenever it rains, because I guess rain is supposed to reveal a hidden world that exists beyond our normal view. And I guess your main character that you play as is a boy or girl or what have you that can only be seen when the rain comes out.
Yeah, somehow your main character has been turned invisible and yet is only seen as the rain bounces off their figure, forming a silhouette. And when, say, if you go under awnings of restaurants in this world, in this city where you are, well, there's no rain, so you're only visible through your footprints.
Yes.
It's
the puddles.
Indeed. It's a really interesting aesthetic presentation. I guess they're going and, well, giving a title for the more artsy crowd, the artistic crowd, if you so will. No word on, well, I guess what gameplay would actually be like, but
or release dates or anything like that.
Exactly, just something, and it's going to come to the PlayStation Network. A very subdued color palette, as you can imagine. Kind of like, imagine, well, London at night, raining.
Yes.
There you go. Done out of Sony's Japan studio. So that, certainly worth talking about as well. But you go from a subdued color palette like Rain for the PlayStation Network to another title, which is pretty much the opposite end of the spectrum.
Yes, the exact opposite end of the spectrum. Where,
and sorry, this one is for the PlayStation 3 called Puppeteer.
Yes, where you play basically as a boy who's been turned into a puppet and you're thrust into a play that you can't escape.
In a magical puppet theater.
Yes, in a magical puppet theater where you can't escape, and you basically, the gist of it is that I got from the trailer is that you have scissors, you steal scissors somehow, and all of a sudden this is your way to get through and, you know, snip through things and try to get your soul back or what have you, through a bunch of, like, ridiculously striking visuals where you go through different scenes of this play, which I guess it's all, the way it looks like it's done is it's all just the scene swaps out underneath you rather than you going through levels or what have you. Like, it's like truly like a theater.
Yeah, the play will just, everything will change in and around you, which if you've ever, say, even done high school theater, the lights come down a little bit and, you know, everyone rushes out and the props and everything else change all around you. But this one, super colorful, super bright, and really going for, I guess, an imaginative child's dreamscape, if you will, and looks, to a certain extent, twisted, but also just, I think it's the bright, lush color palette that, to me, just seemed, like, really awesome.
Yeah.
That's, I can't quite escape, but, I mean, here you have a brand new title for the PlayStation 3 original. Looks intriguing, looks engaging, first party title, fantastic, and, you know, perhaps an aesthetic that maybe appeals a bit more to kids, but Sony wasn't done there, as they had another title for the PlayStation 3 that they revealed before Gamescom that maybe goes for a different demographic, maybe more of the horror survival genre fans.
Yeah, the only preface to it is that it's a PlayStation Move game, so...
That's
kind of... left to reserve judgment to see how they use it, but it's...
It's called Until Dawn.
Yes, and it's basically Sony in video game form doing a teen horror movie.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of thing where you have a bunch of teenagers going to a cabin and during nighttime, bad things happen. You know, there's a million movies like that.
Exactly. Try and survive the night.
Try and survive the night, blah, blah, blah. But in a video game, I mean... How bad can it be, right?
Exactly. It seems interesting, though, as you said, and to preface this, it is making use of the PlayStation Move controller, which, hey, remember that PlayStation Move controller?
Yeah, that other thing that just seemed to... they didn't really promote that well.
I'm pretty sure everyone else has forgotten about it until this point.
Yes, it was the PlayStation's version of the Wii Remote.
Exactly. But with a glowing orb at the end.
Yes.
That would undulate colors. I don't care if undulate was the wrong term to use. It sounded really good. And how often do you get to say undulate?
Yes.
But Until Dawn, as you said, is making use of the PlayStation Move. Now, from what we know initially, you'll be using that Move controller as the flashlight for the game. Which, on the one hand, okay, neat, and I can see that, that's a natural fit. But on the other hand, that seems like it would get real old real fast.
Yeah.
It remains to be seen how they're going to work it out, but it does seem very creepy, very authentic to the horror genre, and seems to have a few staples of, I guess, the teenage horror film of, you know, friends going up to the cabin for, a nice weekend getaway from... whatever there is in the city, high school finals, college, whatever. You know, you have the jock, you have the lovebirds, and, well, pretty much can almost guarantee you from the trailer that the person who, well, probably should get killed first in the game will get killed first in the game. See the trailer for yourself. It's called Until Dawn, and apparently this one also a product born out of Sony's Japan studio. So apparently Sony realizing we need to get more new properties out. Hey, you guys, get to steppin'.
Yeah, I mean, this is all, you know, interesting to me, because it's been a while since I can recall, like, a major video game company, like one of the major companies, actually coming out with new properties, new first-party properties, like...
And this isn't just, you know, it's not a sequel, it's not a party game, it's not a brawler that features all your previous characters or whatever, that is ripping off another company's same game, or anything like that. It's brand new, ground up. Ideas, characters, play, everything brand new, which is fantastic, because in this day and age, the only things that seem to get produced and sell are sequels, or reboots, or anything else of that ilk. So to have these, at least these four that Sony's doing, remains to be seen how they will actually play once they come out, how they will even sell, but at least initially, it's really encouraging.
Yeah.
That they're making the investment, and you certainly have to hope many other companies of the big three, sorry, the two other companies, I shouldn't say many other companies, but the two other companies at least, will put forward that effort. And I should also say of Until Dawn, currently slated for a 2013 release. So it's a while for you to wait for that game on the PlayStation 3, but if you can't wait that long, maybe something you'll need to and use to buy your time to get you until that point is relying on a little game you might have called Team Fortress 2.
Indeed.
In the news this week because, well, you might have thought that, well, Valve as a company with a free-to-play game, they wouldn't really update it anymore. They'd just do minor updates to the Madden Economy store, this, that, and the other thing. No, apparently they've decided to throw that out the window, and...
Well, you can't count on Valve doing anything that you'd think a company would do.
True,
too. I think
too.
That's pretty much established at this point. Valve is its own thing.
They certainly go by the beat of their own drum, the drum that Gabe Newell has built with his own two hands, and beats with his own two hands. I'm sure that's how it goes in the Valve offices. But they going live this week was a brand new update for Team Fortress 2, which added, in addition to the red and blue factions, a whole new faction, a whole new mode. Team Fortress 2 now getting the gray team. The gray team are robots.
Yes, robots.
Not zombies, not vampires, robots. Because robots are still cool.
Yes, and they have their own... They made a really good trailer for this whole thing as well, with their whole movie maker, which they're also sort of pumping up as well, since, as we said a few weeks ago, they're going to be releasing that soon as well, I think for free.
For free as well. But the Greys are robots, as we said, and with them being robots, they're not exactly a playable faction. You can't have the Grey team against the Red team against the Blue team in a three-way dance, so to speak. No. It's more the Grey team robots are the big enemy, and the Red and Blue teams have to fight them off.
Yes, their differences are now put aside, and it's humans against robots.
As it should be, I dare say.
Yes.
As it will be once the robotic uprising comes.
Yes, once Skynet becomes aware and, all that other fun stuff happens and we all realize that we all have a destiny, like John Connor said.
It's true. And
There's no escaping fate.
If you wish to prepare for that, you will certainly be teaming up the red and blue factions to take on wave after wave of these robots, because with the introduction of robots to Team Fortress 2, the game is now getting a new cooperative horde mode. Horde mode, nothing new to video gaming. We've seen it in a number of other titles. Gears of War coming to my mind right away. But wave after wave of angry robots, and in between them, should you survive these waves, you'll have opportunities with some RPG elements to upgrade your character, upgrade your weapons at least, with what you get in the course of each wave, which is nice. So if you make it to the end, you'll get a bit of loot and perhaps even some rare hats. Apparently the aim of the robots is that they want to, they're trying to deploy and detonate a bomb and destroy everyone else on the map, which is unpleasant.
Yes.
You don't want that whatsoever.
Well, that does sound like something robots would do.
It's a very robot motivation. Very disappointing. You thought they'd be original.
Yeah, but really, what can you really expect from soulless killing machines?
That's true, too. And it's hard to argue with success. Bombs do, if you're a robot, a bomb is an easy means to an end, so you have to respect that. And the nice thing is, you don't have to wait for this update at all, for the Man versus Machine update, as it's being called, as it's gone live already. Apparently went live on Wednesday. Went live on Wednesday, that is. So you'll be able to, and are able to, get in there, muck around with robots, and try your hand at it.
Yes, and I just think it's interesting that they're still putting production dollars into a free game.
Not only that, I mean, they're putting seemingly a fair amount of investment into developing this. Apparently this has been in the works for a few years now.
Well, they're also known for their things which are in development for a few years. So. Just putting that out there. Where's Half-Life 2 Episode 3?
Or Half-Life 3.
Half-Life 3.
Or just something.
Some new Half-Life thing. Anyways. I'm just putting that out there.
This isn't going to, quell the appetite for anything Half-Life related, but it's still fun all the same. And, again, a free-to-play game getting a brand new update, brand new mode, and Valve. They're crazy.
Yes, they are.
You cannot put them in a corner. Just like Baby, they don't go in a corner. Went live this week. So, we could keep rambling forever and ever and ever. But we're starting to realize we're going a bit longer than what we probably ever have.
Yes.
And maybe it's about time we start to draw this program to a close, but not before we leave you with something we always like to leave you with, that coming in the form of a blast from the past.
Yes, this week it's a movie which, if you're an American listener, you may have never even heard of or seen. But if you're a Canadian listener, you may not have seen it for at least 10 years. Or
you've hopefully heard of it, though.
You've heard of it, because when it first came out, it was kind of a little bit of a to-do, I think, like an indie darling.
A bit of a cult hit, too.
Yeah, a bit of a cult hit. And the sequel to it recently came out, about 2 years ago or so? 2 or 3 years. We're speaking of FUBAR.
A very Canadian movie.
Yes. Which follows the... the initial original FUBAR is supposed to be like a documentary about the lives of Terry and Diener, which are basically, you know, a couple guys that obviously were teenagers in the 80s and never grew beyond that. So as such, they still like listening to old heavy metal and shotgunning beers and playing street hockey and what have you, and really not holding jobs for very long or what have you. But
living a very simple existence.
Yeah. And
it's a comedy, by the way. It's not an actual documentary.
Yeah, and the first FUBAR has probably the best twist at the end. I think of many movies I've seen, one of the best twists for sure. It's definitely one of those super shocking, can you actually do that in a movie kind of things? I won't spoil it, because if you've never seen it, you should probably see it.
It's well worth it. Well worth the surprise. And it's very, as I said, very Canadian. Very denim.
Yeah, very denim. Very. That's the only way to really put it.
And seems to, I guess, really authentically capture what two leftover people from the 80s would still be like today.
Yeah. Canadian people from the 80s.
Good point. Canadian people.
Full-on mullets. Et cetera, et cetera.
It's an experience. It really is. And it's funny as hell, and it's well worth your time. You can find it in the more cost-effective sections of your local retailers. It's not expensive. I'm sure it's on Netflix as well.
I think it is on Netflix.
Even better. So it's well worth your time. At this point, people, you have no excuses. FUBAR is your blast from the past this week. Go out, watch it, and support Canadian cinema.
Indeed.
Well, folks, that wraps up the longest ever episode of The Arcade.
But we figure we can do this now because, well, the podcast format doesn't mean that we have to really care about anyone else coming on after us or anyone else, you know, who's waiting for their studio time or really cramming in as much as possible into 58 minutes because someone's going to shut your show off early.
And allows us to say what we need to say and probably get out everything we want to get out in the course of a show. And just so happens this week, we had a lot to clearly get through and ram through, and some of it was actually video game related.
Yes.
How about that? But we will certainly try and keep it shorter to the more standard hour format. If we deviate a little, that's fine. But this was a special occurrence.
Sure.
So do bear with us for that. But we hope you can join us next week for next week's edition of The Arcade. And as we've said before, you can always email us info@thearcadeshow.com and our straight up website, thearcadeshow.com. And we hope you can tune in next week. But until then, good night.
Good night.